Our Day and Age. These are true stories of many kinds, gathered from many sources. Stories that reflect the world we live in. Stories of our day and age.
We present Operation Snowdrop, the second program in the new series, Our Day and Age. This true story of the great blizzard which struck northern Scotland in January 1955 has been dramatized by Stephen Grenfell.
My name is Stephen Grenfell and I'm your storyteller. You know, that's the 65th time I've used those words to introduce to you a story of our day and age in the 3 years we've been broadcasting these programs. And believe me, it isn't the first time that I've spoken them with a sinking feeling in the pit of my stomach, because every now and then we succumb to one of humanity's rather endearing failings and bite off more than we can chew. Half an hour, you see, isn't an overlong period of time in which to tell a long and complicated story that's jam-packed with detail. And when, before going up to Scotland, I imagined that Operation Snowdrop could be contained within 30 brief minutes, I must have been cracked. I realized that as soon as I flew up to Wick and began to talk about Snowdrop with my two local contacts, George Bain, the British European Airways manager of Wick Airport, and David Ogue, who happens to be the BBC correspondent in Wick, and more important, the editor of the John O'Groat Journal. Well, we settled ourselves around a table in the John O'Groat office, and because both these gentlemen are extremely pleasant and helpful human beings, we were soon getting along like a house on fire, on a Christian name basis.
When did you leave London, Steve?
3 days ago, David.
And where have you been so far?
Well, let's see. I got the story of the Royal Navy's part in the operation from the Admiralty in London. Then I flew up to Edinburgh and collected a lot of RAF gen from the Air Ministry Information Service there.
Have you been to Kinloss yet?
Oh, yes, indeed. Flight Lieutenant Jack Hutton of the University of Aberdeen Air Training Squadron. He flew me over to Kinloss in a chipmunk yesterday, and I had a long talk with the Wing Commander flying there.
And now, Steve, you've come to Wick to find out what really happened on the spot.
Yes, that's right, George.
Well, both David and I were here during Operation Snowdrop, and we'll be pleased to give you all the help we can.
Well, thank you very much.
And when you've done with us, we'll take you over to the police station.
Uh-huh.
The chief constable's away at the moment, but we'll introduce you to his deputy, Inspector Sutherland.
Good.
And I'm sure he'll explain to you the part the police played during that fortnight.
Mm-hmm.
What he won't tell you, of course, is that they did a really magnificent job. But you can take it from David and me that they did.
Yes, I'm sure they did.
Now, what do you want us to do?
Well, look, just put me in the picture, David. Like hundreds of thousands of our listeners, I've never experienced one of your better Scottish blizzards.
You haven't missed much.
No, I don't suppose I have. Anyway, first of all, I'd like both of you to, well, you know, to explain to me how the whole thing blew up, the extent of the conditions, and how it affected both the towns and the outlying communities in this particular part of the world.
Right, Steve. Mind you, all this happened nearly 4 years ago.
Yes, I know it did, David.
So I think I'd better get hold of our files for January 1955.
Right.
I won't be a moment. We're just next door.
In this way, the story of one of the worst blizzards that northern Scotland has suffered this century began to take shape. Records in the Met Office at Wick Airport show that on the 10th day of January 1955... there were frequent showers of snow accompanied by a fresh northwest wind. These conditions obtained during the following day, and there was a certain amount of drifting. On Wednesday the 12th, snow fell in continuously from 1:30 in the morning until 6, with considerable drifting, and again from 1 o'clock in the afternoon until 6 o'clock, after which there were intermittent snow showers. During the afternoon, the wind increased to gale force strength with an average velocity of 46 miles an hour, but reaching 69 miles an hour on occasion. By 2 o'clock on Wednesday afternoon, then, conditions were serious. Visibility was almost nil, the railway line was blocked at Bower, and all roads in Caithness and Sutherland were in the process of being blocked by snow.
By this time, you must understand that the whole of Caithness and Sutherland, the Shetlands and the Orkneys, were snowed under.
Then it was really bad, eh?
Pretty bad, Steve. Pretty bad.
Well, tell me about it.
Well, by Wednesday afternoon, all road, rail and air transport was stuck.
Uh-huh.
The main roads were littered with cars and lorries that had been abandoned.
Yes.
Bus passengers were given shelter in neighboring houses. At 1:45, we had an aircraft in from Kirkwall with a crew of 3 and 19 passengers, including 2 children. The conditions on the runway were so bad that the passengers had to remain in the aircraft for some hours before we could even get them to the waiting room.
Yeah, that really was some blizzard, wasn't it?
It certainly was. Policemen spent the whole of that afternoon both on foot and in police cars, escorting children home from school.
I see.
In some cases, the smaller children had to be carried through snowdrifts several feet high. Even so, over 100 pupils at Wick High School were unable to get their homes in the surrounding countryside and had to be billeted in hotels and private houses here in Wick.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the time it was freezing, and all over the area people were marooned where they had taken shelter. 6 and 7 foot snowdrifts were commonplace. And after that Wednesday's gale warning, some 70 local and stranger fishing vessels ran for the safety of Wick Harbour. Many people had been listed as temporarily missing, and the horse and cart came into their own again.
For the next 48 hours, these four northern counties of Scotland lay in the paralysing grip of the blizzard. And by Saturday the 15th, people in small, isolated communities were beginning to experience acute suffering as a result of these appalling conditions.
Wick Police, Chief Constable speaking.
County Clerk here.
Hello, Mr. Robertson. How are things?
Not too good. I've just had a request for food to be sent out to Bray Moor urgently.
I've been expecting this.
I have too. Anyway, I've been on to the RAF at Kinloss, and they're going to drop the supplies by plane.
Good.
The Navy wants to help too.
Splendid.
The commanding officer at Lossiemouth has offered the services of two of his helicopters.
Now we're getting somewhere.
The first one should arrive at Wick Airport this afternoon.
We'll give them all the assistance we can when they get here. When do the RAF think they'll be able to drop these supplies at Bray Moor?
Just as soon as they can pack the stuff into the plane.
Right. Keep in touch. Let me know the moment you want anything done.
Well, that's how Operation Snowdrop began, with a flight by an RAF Shackleton aircraft of Coastal Command from Kinloss to Bray Moor.
Kinloss, duty room?
Yes, sir.
Group Captain Thompson on the phone, sir.
Right, thanks. Duty officer, sir.
Oh, Harris, this supply drop for Bray Moor, is it all laid on?
Oh, pretty well, sir.
What are we sending?
Well, sir, I've had a look in our own larder, and so far I've got bread, flour, margarine, cheese, sugar, tea, some tins of meat and some self-heating soup.
Well, that ought to keep them going for a bit.
Should do, sir.
How long will it be before the stuff's been loaded into the shack?
Oh, I should say another 15 minutes, sir.
Good. Now, Harris, we're going to have to do a lot of this sort of thing in the next few days.
Looks like it, sir.
So we wanted to go the right way from the very beginning. With these people in the jam they're in, we can't afford to put up any flaps.
No, sir.
Navigation's going to be the difficulty. Very dicey. With a whiteout like this, no pilot can rely on local landmarks.
No, sir.
Right. Well, I'll come down and brief the first crew myself.
Very good, sir.
That briefing can then be taken as a pattern for every other sortie we fly during this emergency.
Right, sir. I'll have the air crew standing by in the briefing room in 5 minutes.
Muffled up in their heavy, shapeless flying kit, carrying their parachutes, the six young men who are going to initiate Operation Snowdrop leave the briefing room, and leaning forward against the wind, driving down the snow-covered tarmac, they struggle slowly towards the four-engined aircraft and climb aboard. One by one, the four engines burst into life. Then the pilot of the Shackleton gets his clearance from the control tower. And very soon the aircraft is flying high above the white wasteland that stretches in one vast unbroken sweep from horizon to horizon. On all its broad, monotonous expanse, there is no single movement to betray to the watching eyes above the presence of humankind.
Captain crew, we should be in the dropping zone in 5 minutes. Now, we've never done this before, chaps. Before we have a crack at it, I want to be sure everybody is quite certain what his job is. Co-pilot?
Co-pilot to captain. Quite clear.
Engineer?
Engineer to captain. I'm clued up.
Signaler?
Signaler to captain. Okay, sir.
Navigator one?
Navigator one to captain. Clear, sir.
Navigator two?
Navigator two to captain. Okay, sir.
Right. Keep your eyes peeled. Navigating in these conditions is a bit dicey, to say the least.
Ginny?
Yes, Mother?
You best put another log on the fire.
Yes. Well, I'll put the big one on. Awfully cold.
Then let's have the big one. That catch is, you'll soon be warm.
Seems an awful long time, doesn't it, Mother, since Dr. MacDonald rang through on the telephone to tell them we needed food.
What an impatient child you are, Ginny, to be sure. And Braemore isn't the only place in Scotland that's running short of food.
I can't ever remember being as hungry as this.
We can't expect a great aeroplane to leap into the sky packed full of food the moment they hear the doctor's voice and wick.
I suppose not.
These things take time to get ready.
Do you really think, Mother, somebody will fly over in an aeroplane and drop food for us?
If it's humanly possible to fly in terrible weather like this, I'm certain that they will. And our food will drop like manna from the heavens above.
To people like Jeannie and her mother, cut off from the outside world, the Scottish Home Department relayed via the BBC the emergency instructions upon which these folk depended for their very survival.
This is the Scottish Home Service. Here is an important announcement for all communities that have been isolated by the blizzard in northern Scotland. For the benefit of those who have not yet heard the instructions issued by the Scottish Home Department, we shall repeat these instructions at intervals during the day. Today, aircraft of the Royal Navy and the Royal Air Force will begin a series of flights to bring aid to those who require it. If you require medical attention, you must make the signal letter M in the snow. If you require food for human consumption, the letter is F, and the signal letter for animal fodder is C. Now, here are instructions to help you make these letters and enable you to prepare helicopter landing areas and dropping zones.
Nose to captain. I think I can see the dropping area. Yes. There's the letter F at 1 o'clock.
Captain knows. Yes, I've got it. I'll start my run in on an east-west heading. Turning on. Running up.
Co-pilot to captain. Dropping supplies from 150 feet.
Nose to captain. Your speed for the drop must not be above 140 knots.
Captain knows. Roger. 15 degrees of flap.
15 degrees of flap.
150 feet.
Captain to knows. 140 knots. Now.
150 feet.
Nose to captain. Okay, I see the dropping zone clearly. Turn right, 5 degrees. Bomb doors open.
Bomb doors open.
Left. Left. Steady.
Checking off at 150 feet.
Steady. Container's gone.
Good show. Captain to nose. How did you make out?
Nose to captain. Spot on, skipper. We wrapped that linen gear around right across that kitchen cart.
Captain to nose. Line book. It's going to cost you a drink all round, Bill.
Co-pilot to captain. Did you see the kid in the snow waving like a one-armed paper hanger?
Yes, I did. They say you'd wave too if you ended heading to heat for 24 hours. Captain to signaler. Portikin loss on RT.
Signaler to captain. Wilco. Lifeline. This is supply aircraft. Mike Abel. Do you read me? Over.
Mike Abel, this is Lifeline. I read you. Over.
Lifeline. Mike Abel. Mission completed. Returning to base.
Mike Abel, Lifeline. Roger. Very good show. Over and out.
By Sunday, the 16th of January, it had become obvious from the volume of requests being received for food, fodder, and medical assistance that these missions of mercy would have to be developed into a rescue operation of considerable magnitude. That day, the second naval helicopter touched down at Wick Airport, and on the following day, Commander Parker of the Royal Naval Air Station at Lossiemouth arrived at Wick to take command of the operations being carried out from there. His, you know, wasn't the only new face at the airport. By this time, something like 140 newspaper men, radio reporters, newsreel and television cameramen had descended upon this pleasant little fishing port to relay by word and picture to the rest of Britain, and indeed the world, the most dramatic story to come from this particular part of Scotland for a decade.
Ladies and gentlemen of the press, that's one of our helicopters, choppers we call them. I think perhaps we'd better hang on until she's taken off. I'm afraid the chap who designed it didn't intend it to be used during press conferences.
I'm sorry to have kept you waiting, ladies and gentlemen, but we've just had our first evening briefing conference, and as I'm sure you'll all agree, In circumstances like these, we've got to act first and do the talking afterwards. Now, a number of you have asked me just how the police, the roads department, and the services are being coordinated on this operation. So I'll do my best to put you in the picture. Ready? Yes. Temporary headquarters are here at Wick Airport, and Commander Parker of Lossiemouth is in command. The Royal Air Force is operating from their station at Kinloss. They're flying Shackletons mostly. They've done a good deal of food and fuel dropping, but in a day or two, they're going to concentrate on long-range reconnaissance and on dropping fodder for animals. Oh, by the way, the RAF liaison officer here at Wick is Flight Lieutenant Murray.
Hey, what part is the Navy playing?
Well, Captain Jick from Lossiemouth has sent Commander Parker to coordinate the various service operations. At the moment, two helicopters are based here. They're dealing mainly with calls for urgent medical aid, either flying doctors to people who are ill and cannot be moved, or landing at lonely crofts, picking up sick and injured people and lifting them back to hospital.
How do the police fit in with the services?
Extremely well. Amongst other things, they're our intelligence. The chief constable has made this his headquarters, and he's left his deputy in charge at the police station. All the requests for assistance that are received there are split into categories and order of priority, then radioed to a police car outside this building. The message is brought in to the chief constable, then the job is allocated to whoever is dealing with that sort of thing. All clear?
Thank you very much.
Now, just one thing more. The aircraft carrier HMS Glory, with large supplies of food on board, anchored this afternoon in Loch Eribol. That's E-R-I-B-O-L-L, in the north of Sutherland. Helicopters based on Glory have already started to carry out reconnaissance and food drops. So you'll see that we're coping with this thing from three different points. Those three sectors are working separately, but in the closest coordination, and I may say, in the closest harmony.
During the 9 days of Operation Snowdrop, naval helicopters from Wick Airport and RAF aircraft from Kinloss flew 147 sorties. Aircraft and boats from HMS Glory visited no less than 20 different areas, either to transport food or to carry out reconnaissance. How then is it possible to give a really adequate description of the way police and service personnel cooperated under these fantastic weather conditions to maintain the drive and power of a rescue and life-saving operation that had to spread its wings of mercy over the stricken folk and animals of four complete counties? Perhaps the best things to select one out of all these sorties and follow it through from start to finish. All right, let's do that. At the same time, for many reasons, let's mask the identity of those concerned by using names other than their own. The day, Tuesday the 18th of January, the place, a village on the extreme western coast of Sutherland. Let's call it Caltanesi.
Doctor.
Yes, Mr. McKenzie.
Will you promise to tell the truth if I ask you the question I've got to ask?
I'll tell you the truth, Mrs. McKenzie.
My wee son, is he going to die?
I said I would tell the truth. Your son is gravely ill. I alone can't save him, but if we can get him to hospital quickly, then I think the boy will live.
But surely it isn't possible in weather like this to carry a bairn as ill as he is to a hospital.
You're wrong, Mrs. McKenzie. It is possible. We are going to call in the Navy as an ambulance. And if any men on this earth can get your Angus to a hospital and a specialist, they will.
Pray God they do.
They will, have no fear. I'll go straight down to the post office and telephone the Sutherland Police. And they'll send on our call for help to the people responsible for these things.
Donald!
Sir?
Oh, look, Donald. I want both these messages radioed to the airport at once.
Very good, Inspector.
Police Headquarters, Wick. Inspector Sutherland.
Inspector, this is Sergeant Matheson speaking, Sutherland Police.
Uh-huh. What's the problem, Sergeant?
Well, Inspector, we've just this minute received an urgent request for medical aid.
Mm-hmm. Right. Let's have it.
Name, Angus McKenzie, age 12.
12, yes.
The McKenzies live in a croft northeast of Caltanesi, about 5 miles from Loch Inver, sir.
Right.
Map reference 756... 394.
394. Is the lad critically ill?
According to Dr. Ross, he's very bad indeed, Inspector.
Right. I'll let the chief know at Wick Airport immediately.
Dr. Ross wants the lad lifted out as soon as possible for admission to Bignall Hospital.
We'll see to it, Jordan. Now, what sort of weather are you having out there?
That's the trouble, sir. Weather's deteriorating. It's beginning to blow up again.
Don't worry too much. If it's possible to get a helicopter through to Caltanesi, these sailors will do it. Well, before you ring off, Sergeant, make sure that the Mackenzies have got a large letter M outside their crop.
While he talks, the inspector writes the details on a message pad. And within a couple of minutes, this call for help from the extreme western fringe of the White Wasteland is crackling out of a radio receiver in a police car at Wick Airport.
UN to UN2, I have a message for you.
UN2 to UN, pass your message.
UN to UN2, time of origin 1305. Message begins. Urgent request for medical assistance received from police headquarters, Sutherland at 1300. Angus Mackenzie, age 12, seriously ill. Place, Caltanesi, 5 miles from Loch Enver.
100 miles away to the southwest, a 12-year-old boy lies unconscious in the bed in which he has dreamed away every single night of his brief existence. And this time it is no dream. This time he's fighting for his life, watched by the woman who gave him life itself. And yet she cannot save her child. That, if it can be done, will be done by men that she's never seen, men whose names she's never heard.
Lieutenant Commander Jackson's here, sir.
Good. Come in, Alan.
Afternoon, sir.
Can you manage another trip today, Alan?
Good heavens, yes, sir.
You're looking a bit ragged around the edges.
I can cope with another trip, sir.
Good man. I'm afraid this one's a bit of a basket. Here's the jam.
Thank you, sir. Cape Wrath, eh?
You drop food supplies for the Coast Guard there.
Aye, sir.
Here's the map. Then you proceed to Elphin. There's an old woman there who's ill. She's got to be lifted out to Loch Inver.
Aye, sir.
Then you've got to get this youngster, Angus Mackenzie, lifted out of Caltanesi. Map reference and all the details are here. He's in a pretty bad way.
What do Met make the weather, sir?
I don't know, but the Southern police say it's getting worse.
Well, then I'd better get a move on.
Alan.
Sir?
Get that lad out if you can, old chap.
Parkinson and I will have a damn good try, sir.
Yes, I know that. Good luck, Alan.
Thank you, sir.
The rotor blades of the helicopter cleave the drifting snowflakes. The squat machine slowly lifts itself off the snow-covered apron, and then, swiftly and perpendicularly, it rises and drifts to the westward. But it's not destined this day to complete its mission.
Hello, pilot ship, number 12, flat 7.
Wick Control, this is Pedro 06. Do you read me? Over.
Pedro 06, I read you. Over.
Wick Control, this is Pedro 06. Have completed supply drop to Coast Guard at Cape Wrath. Visibility now failing. Weather clamping down. All northwest Sutherland in grip of severe blizzard. Unable to land at Elphin, Loch Inver, or Caltanesi. Fuel running low. I'm returning to base. Over.
Pedro 06, Wick Control. Understood. Bad luck. Over and out.
The helicopter has to return to Wick. In gathering darkness and blinded by driving snow, the pilot manages to land safely. And the following morning, he takes off again for the western coast of Sutherland.
Wick Control, this is Pedro 06. Do you read me? Over.
Pedro 06, Wick Control. I read you. Over.
Wick Control, Pedro 06. Landed on HMS Glory and refueled. Have lifted female patient at Elphin to Loch Inver. Going to have a bash at Caltanesi now. Hold thumbs. Over.
Pedro 06, Wick Control. Wilco, good luck. Over and out.
You know what this reminds me of, sir?
What, Parkinson?
Picture I saw when I was a kid. White Hell of Pensapalu.
Can't remember seeing that.
Well, there's the croft, sir. That reference bang on, too.
Yes, I've got the place.
There's the M.
Right, let's pop down and get the hell out of it with that youngster.
Buffeted by gusts of wind, the helicopter sinks slowly through a swirling curtain of snowflakes and sets itself down gently outside the small stone cottage.
How'd you get, Parkinson?
Aye, aye, sir.
Thank God you've arrived. I'm Dr. Ross.
Lieutenant Commander Jackson.
I didn't dare to hope you'd get through, Commander.
Where's the boy?
Well wrapped up, on a stretcher. They're bringing him out now.
Let's get him aboard, then. Give him a hand, Parkinson.
Aye, aye, sir. Here, let me take that in, ma'am.
Oh, you and your pilot, you're very brave men.
I wouldn't say that. All in the day's work.
Right, I'll take this end. Hold it, Parkinson.
Aye, aye, sir.
Now, I'll lift.
Right, sir.
Come with me.
Okay, sir, here we are.
Give him a hand, Doctor.
Aye, I've got it.
Now, up to me.
There we are.
Easy. That's it. More.
All right.
Hold it. Right. Now, one more shove.
Okay, here we go.
Good, I've got him. Hop in, Doctor, if you want to be dropped above Inver.
Right, I'm coming up.
Angus, my son. Angus.
You're not to worry, Mrs. Mackenzie. We'll have your boy in a warm hospital bed in an hour.
Oh, thank God. Whoever you are, thank God for men like you.
That was just one out of 147 separate missions flown on Operation Snowdrop, one shining facet that illuminates the whole mosaic. Perhaps, who knows, when the world is half a century older, snow and ice will come once more to grasp and hold this very same territory in thraldom. And perhaps an old man will sit with his grandchildren around his atomic fireplace and peer, not into its invisible glow, but into the warmth of his memory. The whispered word snowdrop will fall from his lips. And while the children listen wide-eyed and absorbed, the old man will tell them about the great blizzard that swept across these lochs and mountains when he was a child like them, and which, with its cold fingers, came near to plucking the life from out of his small body.
That was Operation Snowdrop, another program in the series Our Day and Age. The script was written by Stephen Grenfell, who was also the storyteller. Those taking part were Alan Armstrong, George Bain, Albert Bodie, Ian Catford, Ian Dunnett, Henry Donald, Gordon Jackson, Nora Laidlaw, Donald Lightwood, Callum Mill, Effie Morrison, Rolly McMillan, David Ogue, Ian Robertson, and Alistair Selway. For their cooperation during the preparation of the programme, we should like to thank the Royal Navy and the Royal Air Force, Mr. David Ogue, the editor of the John O'Groat Journal, and Mr. J.W. Georgeson, the chief constable of the Caithness Constabulary. The programme was produced by Robin Richardson in the Aberdeen studios of the BBC.